were reversed and take nothing judgments are here rendered against both parties.
May it please the court, in behalf of Giles Berry, I'm Ernest Foree. This suit is one for partition of retirement benefits. The respondent, Elna Hetty Berry, brought this suit in 1979. The facts behind it are the parties were divorced in 1966. At that time, Mr. Berry had been an employee of Southwestern Bell Telephone Company for something over 26 years. There was nothing done about the retirement fund or potential retirement at the time of the divorce. Either in the property settlement agreement which was entered into between the parties or in the judgment. At that time it was thought that the retirement potential was not property capable of division by the divorce court. The parties discussed the matter and concluded that the matter should not be presented to the court. Mr. Berry had not been employed long enough, or he'd been employed long enough but hadn't acquired the age to be able to retire. He continued to work for Southwestern Bell after the divorce in 66 until he retired in 1978. In 1979, the respondent filed this suit to obtain a portion of the retirement benefits. Because of the earlier history, the petitioner here, Giles Berry, refused to acknowledge that Mrs. Berry might be entitled to any part of these retirement benefits. This was a non-contributory retirement plan. The employee contributed nothing to it. All contributions, all funds were provided by the employer. The reason they didn't try to do anything at the time of the divorce about this retirement was this court's opinion in Herring against Blakely, wherein it seemed that the court was turning its opinion on whether or not benefits were vested. As we considered the term at that time, no one thought that any possible future retirement benefits that Berry might be entitled to draw were vested. In any event, this suit was filed, was tried. The trial court found that the plaintiff, Mrs. Berry, was entitled to share in the retirement after Berry had retired to the extent of 50% of what would have been the retirement pay at the time of divorce if Berry had then been entitled to retire. After the divorce, Berry continued some 12 years to work for Southwestern Bell. There were numerous pay increases, 12 or 14 at least. There were changes in the retirement plan also. Mrs. Berry adopts the attitude that she's entitled to a fraction of all of the retirement when it is received. That is at 78 and after. We contend that the matter of the increases in the meantime, during which there was no marriage between these parties, and no contribution of any sort by Mrs. Berry to additional retirement benefits which were earned by Berry. The trial court determined, the evidence shows, that the amount of pension, retirement pay, which Berry could have drawn at the time of divorce, if he had had the appropriate age, would have been $221.21 per month. All of his employment to that point by Southwestern Bell was during the marriage of the parties. So the entire retirement benefit at that time, $221 a month, would have been community property, and the non-employee spouse, Mrs. Berry, would have been entitled to $110.60.50. Both parties appealed this decision to the trial court, and the case was transferred by you folks to the Eastland Court, where the Eastland Court reversed the trial court's opinion as to the matter of sharing in benefits accruing after divorce, and provided that determined that Mrs. Berry would be entitled to 34.21% of all of Berry's retirement that he might receive from the time of retirement on. We say that that disposition is unjust and inequitable for the reason, among others, the petitioner's income, his salary, more than doubled during the period after divorce. The plan of retirement was changed a number of times and liberalized in some respects. And we say that it's not just or right to permit the ex-wife to share in what he acquired from his efforts after the divorce, that that should be considered his separate property. We urge that the Court of Appeals should consider the decision in the matter of the marriage of William D. Rister and Jane L. Rister, an Amarillo Court of Appeals, civil appeals case from 1974, having no error history. In that case, again, a telephone company employee, incidentally, but this was a divorce case and not a after-divorce case, a partition. The trial court held there that the date for the determination of a fraction of benefits would be the date of the divorce and the facts as they were at that time, which is exactly what we contend should be done here. Even though this is not a divorce case, this is a post-divorce matter.
Doesn't the Eastland Court say that that case is distinguishable?
Sir?
Doesn't the Eastland Court say that that case is distinguishable?
I couldn't tell if they paid much attention to it, Judge.
Well, language, In Re Marriage of Rister, cited by the former husband, is distinguishable. And you're saying it's in point?
Yes, sir, I am. That's it. The principle is the same. The the Amarillo Court could have decided that the fraction of retirement to which the ex-wife's entitled would be whatever fraction he ultimately received. But as the Amarillo Court said, that's any benefits accruing as compensation for services rendered after divorce are not a part of the estate of the parties subject to division on the divorce. I don't know quite why the Eastland Court adopted the attitude that it did. Additionally, we have cited in our amended motion for application for writ of error, the Ryan case out of Beaumont. The Ryan case, as the opinion as published, did not include all of the opinion. The court ordered that the latter part of it should not be published. That's the pertinent part, we thought. It affects our situation, at least. There, the parties were married twice. They were together, married for a bunch of years, and divorced, and shortly remarried. And then shortly after that, divorced again. There was no division made of the retirement rights or benefits or possibilities at the time of the first divorce. So the court rationalized that the benefits in the community part of it, at least, the parties became tenants in common, or joint tenants, in that portion, and that the, of course, the non-working, non-employee spouse is not entitled to any part of the separate property, that interest that accrued after the divorce while they were unmarried. The Beaumont court found that in this unpublished portion of their opinion that the employee ex-spouse had a good point, that the value of the wife's portion of these retirement benefits and the increases in those benefits accruing because of service after the sale. Well, I'm sorry, I have to find myself. And they reversed the trial court and sent the matter back to the trial court for determination of the value of the retirement potential at the time of the second divorce. And that's what we say should be done here. And there's another case that sheds perhaps some light, or it's in somewhat the same vein, and that's the El Paso Court of Civil Appeals opinion in Schappel against Schappel, the 1976 case. This was a military case where the court held ultimately that retirement benefits should be calculated on the serviceman's rank or grade at the time of divorce. This is not the pay, but the grade at the time of divorce, and not on the basis of any subsequent promotions. But we say that's in the same vein as our present case. Perhaps the strongest case I found it on rereading Herring against Blakely. This court's decision in 1965 involving retirement rights in an annuity and also a profit sharing arrangement. In that case, this court said, sent the reverse and sent back to the trial court for determination of the value of the employee spouse's interest in the plans on the date of divorce, and ordered that the trial court, after ascertaining that value, award to the ex-wife one half of the value of the ex-husband's interest. This is complicated by the fact that the man had died in the meantime, and there was a receiver for the community estate and a trustee appointed by the will of the decedent. But this court did rule there that the interest value should be determined as of August 2, 1960, the date of the divorce, and award made accordingly, wife one half. But we say that those cases should be considered determinative in this case, and we ask that as a matter of justice and equity that you reverse the Court of Appeals, and we'd like to come clear all right, but we won't, and affirm the trial court. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
We will hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Hagler will present argument on behalf of the respondent.
May it please the court. We are not today asking for increases after the divorce based on contributions that Mr. Berry made post-divorce. Mr. Forey's esteemed counsel says that the contributions from the defendant petitioner herein should not be considered in awarding the wife, the ex-wife, her portion of this retirement plan. What about increases after retirement? The evidence showed that the retirement plan increased approximately $100 per month about a year after Mr. Berry retired. To what do we attribute that $100 increase? Mr. Forey says that his salary, Mr. Berry's salary, more than doubled since the divorce in 1966. I must beg your indulgence in not recalling that fact being in evidence. However, there was evidence that there were a number of increases post-divorce, and there were a number of changes in the retirement plan post-divorce, but the key fact with regard to that evidence was the fact that, in Mr. Berry's own words, the increases post-divorce barely kept up with inflation, if at all. So our position is not that merit increases by Mr. Berry or increased productivity by Mr. Berry post-divorce should be divvied up and given to Mrs. Berry, but simply that Mrs. Berry, whatever the value of Mrs. Berry's share, should be given to her, and that that value should include inflation. Inflation would certainly treat both shares equally over the period post-divorce. Mr. Forey refers to Mr. Berry's efforts after divorce being his separate property or contributing to a fund that is his separate property. But the question is that that was a fund that had several interests in it, and it's a question of how much is Mrs. Berry's interest worth. Mr. Forey relies on the Ryan case, the unpublished portion. But the Ryan case remanded for the very purpose of determining how the post-divorce increases should be apportioned, and for the purpose expressly, in the words of the court, to determine the value of the wife's share. There's no discussion whatsoever in the Ryan opinion concerning the issue that we have raised here of inflation and concerning the factual issue which we developed in the trial court in this case, which was not developed in the Ryan case, and that was the relationship of the post-divorce increases to inflation and the conclusive, unrebutted showing that the post-divorce increases in our case did not exceed inflation. And therefore, we're not asking for the merit increases, there weren't any, or the increased productivity of Mr. Berry after divorce to be given to us in part at all.
Counselor, on that point, are you saying that this was not in any way negotiated? I don't know, maybe it's not in the record, but pretty general understanding that particularly Southwestern Bell and CWA negotiates with management and they arrive at a fringe packet to go along with salary. And you're saying that that had nothing to do post-divorce with this retirement?
Your Honor, is the question related to how the plan was changed post-divorce?
The question is related to your statement that this was merely taking care of inflation as opposed to a negotiated so much salary, so much fringe benefit each year or each time the contract was renegotiated.
The evidence was silent as to the nature of the changes in the plan post-divorce, and so I don't know how I could answer that question in relationship to how the structure of the plan may have changed post-divorce, except that it did change several times. Regardless, though, of how the structure of the plan may have changed post-divorce, the evidence showed that the amount of retirement benefit that Mr. Berry was to receive was based on all of his years of employment, and the mathematical formula was tied to the latter end, I believe it was the last 5 years. Which
wasn't it, instead of the last 5 years, the highest pay during a consecutive 60-month period, which that turned out to be the last 5 years, but it could have come earlier, assuming he became less productive in the later years of his employment.
I think that's right, Your Honor. So we may have a question there in terms of the last 5 years or the most productive 60 months being outside the marital time frame. But it's my understanding that almost all retirement plans that I've had any knowledge of are based on the latter end of the retirement plan. It's a simple mathematical calculation to arrive at some incentive for the employee to stay on the job and for him to hopefully be more productive in the later end. But in this case, we have shown in this evidence that there's a continuous curve, so to speak, in terms of his income relative to inflation, that the value of his services remained constant over the period of time. There's no evidence to the contrary on the point of the value of his services remaining constant over time. And therefore, we think the fractional time formula is the appropriate one, and we think this court in several cases has approved the fractional time formula. The fractional time formula has been with us in other Court of Civil Appeals cases, and we see no evidence in this case that would warrant the application of any other formula besides the fractional time formula. I think it's interesting that Judge Harless, the trial judge, actually ruled with us on this fractional time formula, first of all, and the record clearly shows this, but then in reliance, we believe misplaced reliance, on the Rister case, he went back and gave us only 50% of the 1966 value unenhanced by inflation.
Was there any testimony by anybody as to the effect of inflation upon the retirement benefits?
Yes, sir. The only testimony on that point, sir, was by Mr. Berry, and his testimony was to the effect his increases after divorce barely kept up with inflation, if at all.
No expert testimony?
No, sir. And on the question of whether there should have been or who had the burden of producing any experts, I think Judge Guitard's opinion in the 1973 Death Holmes No. 2 case is helpful. We had a similar situation there where it was a question of who should have proved there was a disproportionate amount applicable to one party or the other. And Judge Guitard said that the employee, the salaried employee, since it's his retirement plan, if he thinks that some portion of it, some time frame of it, was worth more than some other portion or time frame, then the salaried employee had the burden to come forward and show that the disproportion existed.
If it's community property equally owned, why should one have more burden than the other just because of ownership?
Well, that's a good point, Your Honor, but Judge Cattard dealt with that very issue and said that he is the salaried employee. It is his company that's looking out for his interest. He has a better access to that information. He has a better access to the way it's figured and so on, and all the other equities being equal, that tipped the scales in Judge Cattard's thinking toward putting it on the salaried employee to come up and say there should be some disproportionate interest. Now, I think the dates and the time frames are set forth fairly clearly in both our briefs. We're talking about a marriage while employed of 26 years, and we're talking about a period, total period of employment of 38 and one half years. One of the cases, one of the more recent cases, did the fractional time formula on the basis of days instead of years, but there's been no complaint about us doing it on the basis of years in this case. What is the difference between what the trial court first awarded and what we're now asking for, on the one hand, and what the trial court finally awarded and what Mr. Berry and Mr. Forey are asking for now, is I figure it is a difference between $323.74 a month versus $221.21 a month. Now, that 323 I just figured it a minute ago is taking the form of the fractional percentage of 34.21% and multiplying that by the amount Mr. Berry was receiving at the time of trial, which again was not the amount he was receiving at the time he first retired, the increase being some $100 or so after retirement.
Let me ask you this question. Let us assume that Mr. Berry had quit work in 1966.
Yes, sir.
After 26 years of employment with Southwestern Bell.
Yes, sir.
Would he, upon reaching age 60, have been entitled to Southwest Bell benefits, retirement benefits?
If I understand the question, there were two requirements for him to retire. One was attained age of 60, if I remember, and the other was so many years of employment. And he had met one of them in 66, and counsel mentioned which one, and I don't remember which one it was. Did I misunderstand the question?
My question is, let us assume that at the time of the divorce, he also terminated his employment with Southwest Bell.
Yes, sir.
After having worked there 26 years. But we all know that in 1966, he had not yet attained the age of 60.
Right.
My question is, would he nevertheless have been entitled to retirement benefits upon reaching the age of 60, even though he was no longer working for Southwestern Bell?
I don't know the answer to that, but let's assume he could. In that case, it would be a simpler issue here to follow our rationale of applying the increases that have nothing to do with productivity post-divorce. Your question pinpoints the precise issue we're trying to focus on here, and that is, the increase is attributable to the fact that the money's just sitting there, invested, growing. And in that case, it would be 50-50.
All we know is that in 1966, if he could have retired, he would have drawn down something like $220 in retirement benefits.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Is there any evidence in the record that would have indicated that if he quit in 1966 at the time of divorce, what his retirement benefits would have amounted to if and when he started drawing them?
No, sir. Not to my knowledge. I might comment just parenthetically on ERISA briefly. It was passed in 1974, and the policy of the law was one of growth and security, and it contains a number of prudent investor rules. And this is important to our argument on the point of growth after the divorce that has nothing whatever to do.
Yes, Jim, are you going to discuss Herring versus Blakely, how you would distinguish the court's language in there?
I hadn't planned on it, Your Honor. I'd be happy to welcome a question on that.
It may not be necessary. The counsel read from the language that says to be determined as of the date of the divorce.
Well, I think the issue is the value determined as of the date of the divorce in terms of the time factor. But if that's to be interpreted to mean that the value at the date of the divorce is frozen and does not appreciate, then I think that's a wrong application of the principle that's set forth in some of these opinions, such as the Rister case and the...
Well, the way we appreciate most things is with interest. You owe something at a certain date, not paid. You get interest.
Yes, sir. And when you have a situation where a person's salary just keeps up with inflation, then that is your frame of reference. Whatever inflation was is your frame of reference, not only for the amount of the salary, but also in terms of the amount of the benefit that he's receiving based on that salary.
Well, if we carry that to the ridiculous way, he'd be charged with working good for and showing up on a job, carrying it out. I guess you could charge him with prudent management of her one half.
You're not contending, are you, counsel, that she was entitled to part of his salary during that 12-year period when they were not married?
No, sir. No, sir. In the Cameron case that you gentlemen just wrote on several months ago, you reiterated the rationale why we don't have alimony and why we are very concerned about making sure that we don't take separate property and give to the other spouse, but we are only concerned with community division, the appropriate division of the community portion. And the retirement benefits are community. His salary post-divorce is not community. But the retirement benefit is definitely community. It's a question of how much of it is attributable to her share as of the time of the divorce, 1966.
Well, in order to prove that up, Counselor, and to understand what Judge Barry asked, would it not be your burden of proof to show what that $220 he was due had he retired at the time of divorce would have earned if invested at that time, as opposed to saying, okay, he got all these raises, made a whole lot more money, therefore we're going to claim all of that. But actually, according to your theory, prove today's value of her share of that retirement at the date of divorce?
Your Honor, I think that the question of how much it should have been worth or would have been worth is not as precisely the issue as how much it really was worth. And how much it really was worth is how much he is receiving now divided by the fractional time formula.
Well, you seem to want to ignore the fact, though, that his separate time, talent, toil, to use a word we've used recently, went into determining what it's presently worth. When, as Judge Barry mentioned, the time honored, I thought, without question, means of determining values are by using the money involved and applying rates of interest to whatever to determine present value of future income or present value of past income.
Yes, sir. Abstractly, I think that interest would be the way to arrive at it. But in the actual rubber meets the road, that is not the way the fund managers arrive at the value. They invest the money and whatever they get on it, that's what they pay. It was not a defined contribution plan at all. It was based on the productivity of the plan and the investment of the plan. And so the question of proving what it would have been worth is not the issue. The question is what it really was worth. Now, as to your question about her getting a share of his work after the divorce, that is severed out of it by the fractional time formula. She is not having any interest. We're not asking for any interest in his post-divorce productivity. Since his productivity stayed right even with inflation, the fractional time formula takes out that whole point.
Well, to follow your argument there, wouldn't the right thing have been done to brought in the plan manager and say, okay, this $220 in 1960, now manage the way you manage it, what's it worth today? But that's not what the present retirement is based on, as I understand. The fact that present retirement is based on what he earned starting some 7 years after they were divorced, and then the following continued 60 months.
Yes, sir. Well, if that's what should have been done, then we must reach the burden of proof issue. And I had been clerking for Judge Guitars in 73 and was familiar with death homes, so I felt like the death homes was good law and that the other side had the burden of proof if there was going to be any variance from the straight time formula. And they didn't prove it, so I didn't think we had to rebut anything on the question of the value being any different based on any other basis besides the time.
Counsel, have any of the military retirement cases considered the point of the promotions other than Shapley?
Yes, sir. There are a number of military retirement cases, and I'm troubled.
I'm saying, but, have they considered this point in that?
Yes, sir. The military retirement cases, as I understand it, say that the wife's not entitled to any portion of the retirement based on merit promotion post-divorce. And that troubles me. I don't know what the policy of the law should be with regard to prospective and hypothetical future merit increases that would go beyond inflation or go more than inflation. It seems to me from a policy point of view, completely apart from the facts of this case, there's two choices to go. One is to follow the fractional time formula, regardless of merit promotions, which there are cases saying you can't do that. Or the other thing is just to leave retirement plans out of the divorce entirely and allow them to motion to sue severance later. Seems to me from a policy point of view, those are the only two choices available because you don't know whether that captain is going to be a colonel one of these days.
Or whether probably most military promotions are based on time. And you had to put in the time as a captain before you could make major, even though it took some time after that, but you still needed the captain's time to count on that. So it's somewhat similar to this. That's the reason this fellow got increases, I guess, wasn't it? That he had,
well, sir.
His first 26 years helped on the last 12.
Well, Judge Barrett, that's why we asked him the question. Did your raises, did all these raises that you had, did they go beyond inflation? Were they less than inflation or about the same as inflation? And he gave us just exactly the answer we hoped he would, so we wouldn't have to worry about bringing in a CPA and proving up the any other basis for it, even though we didn't think we had the burden of proof for it.
Let me change your fact situation a little bit. Instead of a non-employee contributory plan as we have here, let's assume that we have a KEO plan, self-employed individual who for years has been contributing to a KEO plan that's been invested, just as I'm sure that Southwest Bell has invested the money in their plan here. And let us assume that this individual continues after divorce to invest in KEO. Would you claim that you were entitled to half proceeds at the time of his retirement?
No, sir. In that case, somebody would have to go in and show the contributions made up to the time of the divorce and then have some expert testify as to discounting, or I'm not a CPA, but to show the value of earlier dollars relative to later dollars and to show that the post-divorce contributions by the salaried spouse amounted to a certain fractional portion of the retirement benefit.
Why would the same logic apply here, that there should have been evidence that the $221 in 1966 would have been worth in 1978?
For the reason that when he said that his post-divorce increases just barely kept up with inflation, then everything that goes into that retirement plan is based on all the years of employment, which the plan expert testified that that was the case. And obviously earlier dollars would amount to, with the increases that were coming by virtue of inflation and investment, the earlier dollars would constitute a greater portion of the retirement plan later than the later dollars would. So the fractional time formula accurately discounts his work post-divorce as far as it went into the plan. I had another thought about Judge Barrett's question, but I lost my train of thought. Maybe I'll think of it in a minute.
I forgot it already.
Did you? Well, maybe it'll come back to me in a minute. I would point out, too, that the under our reply point number 6, which is in reply to their point number 5, taking the 1966 value, that is, one half of it, was the precise rationale that was rejected in the Bankston versus Taft case. It's the Beaumont 1981 writ dismissed case, 612 second 217, and somehow I overlooked that case in doing my brief. But the argument that Mr. Forey is making on behalf of Mr. Berry in this case, that is, you take the 1966 value, that is, half of what it would have been in 1966 was expressly rejected in the Bankston v. Taft case in favor of the Searley-Taggart-Gongwer rationale, fractional time formula that we're asking for here. Now, what do we have left of this issue of disposition retirement plans since Cameron? I don't think we have much left of it in terms of fractional dispositions being appropriate, except the question of what are post-divorce increases. Now, there's a lot of language in the cases about post-divorce increases and how the non-salaried spouse, and I have to say that very carefully in this day of women's lib, the non-salaried spouse should not get anything of the post-divorce increases. But none of these cases that say that deal with the question of inflation and deal with the question that her portion, whatever it is, continues to grow in that retirement plan, just like his portion does. Now, to do what Rister did, and to do what the unpublished portion of the Ryan case did, is to say that the non-salary spouse's share should not appreciate after the divorce. And I just don't think that those cases should be interpreted that way or should be applied that way to prohibit the non-salary spouse from getting her appropriate share of it. As a footnote to the Cameron case, there was the case of Moore versus Jones, which just was decided a couple of months ago. And I checked with the clerk this morning, and there's been no writ history on this. But the reason I bring this case up, this Moore case, is the San Antonio case decided September 15, 1982, which was 6 days after this new federal statute, which says, as Cameron recognized, that now military retirements are not preempted, and that military retirement benefits are available now, again, to the non-salaried spouse, ex-spouse. The Moore case was decided 6 days after this new statute.
Is that a published opinion?
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. It's 640 Southwest 2nd, 391. And it's interesting, in this case of Moore, that an apportionment formula, it was assumed that an apportionment could be done. What this case involved was cost of living allowances on a military retirement. The former retirement plan had been already severed in the divorce, and then the retired colonel got a cost of living allowance, and the wife came in to divide that up. And the court assumed that the law was still the case that post-divorce retirement plans of military personnel were a preempted area and therefore did not allow the wife to get her share of that. The court was unaware of the statute having been passed 6 days before, or signed into law 6 days before, that changed the law. And the importance of that case, I think, is that had the court known in San Antonio the law was changed, the federal law was changed, the result would have been exactly what we're asking for here, and that is cost of living allowance increase on the military retirement should be divided up and given to the wife. I notice my time is up. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. We will hear the reply from the petitioner.
Let me touch on the last thing first in this instance. Counsel's citing is Moore against Jones, this fairly new San Antonio case. The aftermath of a divorce case. In the divorce court did, in fact, determine the value of military retirement and awarded to the wife a certain number of dollars. Subsequently, the wife then filed this present case seeking to get that amount increased. This is a different situation. There was a division of all of the community assets at the divorce in this instance, and there's a subsequent attempt to modify that. To answer Judge Kilgarland's question about what would have happened had Giles Berry resigned from phone company at the time of the divorce, would he then ever have been entitled to receive retirement pay when he reached 60? The answer is no, as I understand it. I think you will find materials in Plaintiff's Exhibit 4 in the Statement of Facts, which is answers taken on written interrogatories of the head of Southwestern Bell's retirement benefits branch in Dallas. I think you will find in that the plan is not vested in the employee's right until they reach retirement age. The employee contributes nothing. And further, I don't believe that there is, in fact, any contribution made by Southwestern Bell into a fund each and every payday or year or whatever. I think they're paying it out of pocket. Now, perhaps you find some light in some of those exhibits, and there are a number of them attached to Plaintiff's Exhibit 4. As to counsel's contention that the increases in pay just kept up with inflation, let me find that. Statement of Facts, page 37-38. Mr. Berry was on the witness stand being cross-examined by Mr. Peranio. who's an able cross-examiner, inquired about the number of pay increases and so forth. Question. Now, sir, are you aware, this may sound like a silly question, but are you aware of whether or not there's been any inflation since 1966 in this country's economy? Answer. I'm aware it's been very high in the last year since I retired, or 2 years I retired, yes. Question. Sir, without trying to be real specific, could you give us an idea of whether or not your raises generally have been somewhat more than the annual inflation rate for the given year, somewhat less than the annual inflation for the given year, or about the same as the annual inflation for the given year since 1966? Answer, I would say they were less. Question, your raises have been somewhat less than inflation? I believe so, but I'm no authority on that. He's not an authority, and I don't believe his opinion should be considered as binding on this court. Again, I would remind the court that in the Blakely, hearing against Blakely case, this court did determine that the calculation of the wife's interest should be as of the date of divorce. The same result was obtained without referring to hearing against Blakely by the Amarillo court in Rister, and by the Beaumont court in Ryle. We renew our plea that you reverse the Court of Civil Appeals and affirm the judgment of the trial court. Any questions, I'll try.
Thank you, Counselor.